sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It's been a big week and a big month for stocks. The big boys come to the rescue. The debt ceiling is now in countdown mode, and our guest today, John Stein of Betterbit. All this and much more on episode number 435 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, welcome. Andrew Horowitz here on a day that we are looking back at markets, not only for the week, but the month. We've had quite the rally that's happened. Snap back turnaround from the lows at the end of the quarter for the third quarter of 2015. And here we are, last week of October, pulling into the final week, October 31st at the end. And we're going to see some pretty interesting things happen after all we are, up from the lows about 11%. Off the bottom, one of the best months in years. And now the S&P 500, Dow Jones, all positive territory for the year after seeing some very substantial losses. Now, some of that positive move is masked a bit because of the fact that many of the large caps have outperforming, and we're seeing things like still pharma and materials and a variety of other sectors not doing as well. But generally speaking, consumer discretionary, staples, technology have held up extremely well and, in fact, surprised a lot of people with their recent earnings. The move off the bottom was pretty rapid. It has really not seen any kind of significant downturn ever since the thought that, hey, you know what? There's going to be some more stimulus coming our way. And it was delivered in terms of at least some jawboning last week when we saw that Mario Draghi came out with a commentary that was pretty, I would say, significant. He used very specific words, very specific sentence structures to convey that, you know, the ECB may be ready to actually add more to their quantitative stimulus program that they've been doing. The quantitative easing where they've been buying bonds, and something that was unheard of about 2 years ago, as a matter of fact, probably constitutionally illegal, but they went ahead with it and they were approved. And now they thought that, well, $1.5 trillion or so would probably do the trick, bring up inflation, restart the economy. And don't you know, didn't work out so well so far. As a matter of fact, Europe is still in a deflationary spiral. And one of the big causes is due to the fact that they are so aggressive in their quantitative easing that it has been helping to push the dollar higher, which, of course, helps deflate much of the world's commodities. And that is creating a real significant negative atmosphere and environment for much of the world, inclusive of Europe. So some of the things that they're doing is, in fact, helping. But some of the things they're doing are having some negative impact as well. So we'll see what happens when he did mention that sometime in the future. I don't know if he's just bluffing or if there's actually something on the way. But the euro clearly saw a major decline, about 2% down to the 110 region after he discussed this. Now, on the back of that, we saw that China was actually reducing down their interest rates, the reserve ratio that they have in terms of bank lending. That's their key interest rates. Another move lower, I think it's the 8th or so since November. This is pretty significant, obviously flashing a signal that the Chinese economy is still seeing a very soft patch, and it is needing a good amount of help from the Central Bank of China. So we saw that. Now we have meetings coming up this week with the Fed, and we have the Japanese Central Bank coming out with some commentary, and it looks like it's an absolute race to the bottom. It looks like the currency devaluation situation that's going on around the world and the the commensurate uptick in equities with the fascination with stimulus and the excitement over stimulus and liquidity into the markets has really pushed things higher. Now, that's not the only thing that helped out, but that was the initial, I think that was the initial push off the bottom in September into October. Then we had some earnings that came in pretty soft in a lot of companies, but at the end of the week, this week or last week, we saw that there was a significant move due to the fact that Google, Amazon, and Microsoft really did well this quarter, much better than was anticipated. We went from about 55% of stocks that were beating estimates to about 70% this week. A lot of companies reported this week. So we're back up to the level where the average, the overall average company beating is about 70%. So we're right there. Revenue is still falling short. And there has been a clear demarcation between those companies that are doing well and those companies that are not. For example, we saw that last week, while there's some great news out of the technology companies, currency headwinds were having a major problem for, showing a major problem for a company like Whirlpool, who said that about $3.5 billion charge to revenue due to the fact that they have seen a significant impact of currencies, the dollar strengthening, as well as the fact that the emerging markets are soft. I mean, there was something like about $5 billion differential in terms of their earnings or their, you know, top to bottom line, due to the weakness in much of the world, due to the global slowdown, as well as the majority of that, about $3.5 billion being attributed to the currency headwinds with the dollar stronger. Now, the stock swooned about 14% on that news. That's a pretty rough move for Whirlpool. But now we are seeing that, you know, there is this kind of, I guess you would say that the companies that have been able to handle or navigate around the whole dollar and the currency issue to those that can't. Now, in terms of Amazon, much better numbers. They were actually profitable again. Second quarter in a row that Amazon came out profitable. One of the things that happened was that Jeff Bezos realized, I think, that much of the infrastructure build and the expansion of the various warehouse facilities and all the money that they were putting into things like maybe some of the losing items like the fire and some of the things they were doing that were, I guess, experimental. That would probably be the best way to describe it. Well, we're going to slow down on that. And what happened was that estimates were for a loss this quarter. Company came in with a very nice profit, both on the top and the bottom line, and beat expectations by a pretty wild range, I must tell you. And Jeff Bezos came out and said that, you know what, we're going to continue to be profitable moving forward. So the guidance was very good. The beat was very good. Everything looked very solid. In fact, Jeff Bezos, or Bezos, the founder and CEO of Amazon, is now officially the third richest person in the United States, just behind Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. Pretty cool. We saw some other things on the negative side, like Pandora Media. They missed, obviously, when Apple came out with their announcement that about 6.5 million users are now paying for their streaming music service, that maybe we should have scratched our heads and said, watch out, Pandora. Something's not right, and there's a bit of a movement away from your platform into Apple's platform. At least they're stealing some share. And as such, Pandora was down by 35% post-earnings. So that VMware also missed estimates. There's a whole interesting situation now brewing with this Dell EMC takeover, where Dell's coming in offering about $33 per share for EMC, and EMC never traded anywhere near that number. And as VMware is falling, and as there is much concern over this whole deal and a lot of confusion, we talked about that a few times, and last week we talked about that with Frank Curzio. If you didn't catch that episode, you really need to do that, because not only did we talk about some of the details behind this deal and some other earnings issues, and he did talk about Apple, which will be coming out with the earnings this week, he mentioned one particular sector that you need to stay away from, some stocks in that sector that potentially could blow up, and gave a lot of details about that. Now, you can listen to it, but I'll also tell you that it's the oil sector, and we've already seen $6.5 billion of write-downs in that sector. And analysts are predicting plenty more to come. So there's some issues there that really have to be looked at. Let's take a quick move to what happened last week in terms of economics. and look at what's going to be moving markets this week ahead, because this week should be very interesting with the end of the month coming, with momentum in the camp of the stimulus bulls. And the big question, whether or not this whole move by China is something good or bad. Is this actually something that can be relied on? They also came out over the weekend with a commentary that they're going from short-term stimulus to more of a five-year plan because, well, they need to keep that GDP between 6 and 7. So that 7% number that they've been talking about for some time, the number that they thought was very sustainable, is all of a sudden suspect. Because now they're talking about 6 to 7%. And there's been some people coming out with an analysis that, well, the numbers weren't that bad when they came out with a 6.9%. There was a lot of domestic consumption. They're really getting away from the whole export area, and that's actually good for the long-term nature of growth for the country. But there's been others been really concerned about the fact that they're really not buying commodities. They're not building infrastructure. The stimulus is being used to plug up a lot of holes in the banking industry, and the loans that are outstanding and the bad loans and the artificial buildup of the real estate sector, as well as their overall meddling in equity markets by direct purchases, is really a problem. Well, we'll have to see how that plays out. It's going to be very interesting. Last week, we did see that existing home sales did better. We saw that the National Association of Realtors came in with about a 4.7% gain for residential resales, existing home sales, and looked at an annualized rate of about 5.55 million units. That was the second best level since February 2007. And I think a lot of that has to do with not only in a low interest rate environment, there's a lot of people that are concerned about, hey, you know what? This could be the last chance to actually pick up a house at these extremely low rates because the Fed has been hinting about a higher rate environment. I mean, how much lower can it go, right? How much lower can you get a mortgage for in the future? 0.5%? You can always refinance if you have to. Why not try to see if you could pick it up right now at a level that may be really beneficial for pricing of homes as well as for mortgage levels. There was also good news in the housing starts area, 6.5% increase in housing starts. And that was a year over year of 17.5% for housing starts. That was good. We did see that due to the fact that there was that major move in the euro and the commensurate move with the dollar higher, that oil and gold moved lower. We did see that that gold was down about 1.7%. Crude oil, WTI crude, dropped about 5.5% last week. Finished up at about 44.5 or so. Now, coming up this week, we have new home sales on Monday and earnings from companies like Cheesecake Factory. On Tuesday, we're going to see durable goods. Now, what we want to see with durable goods is that while they've been slowing considerably, and a lot of that is due to the fact that the dollar has strengthened, we're probably going to see a better number because we did see weakening prior to this week, prior to last week too, over the last month or so, as the Fed has stepped up their rhetoric about possibly not doing anything with interest rates for some time. Dollar came down a bit, and I would venture to say that probably durable goods is going to look a bit better than it has. The big question is going to be, with the dollar strengthening as it has again, particularly because of the big move that we saw on Thursday and Friday, how is that going to play out with durable goods moving forward? We're going to also see the August Case-Shiller Home Price Index and the Conference Board Confidence Index. That's usually the last week of the month on the Tuesday. We'll see earnings from Anadarko Petroleum. Alibaba will be very interesting to take a look at. Apple, Bristol Myers, Coach, Comcast, Corning, Express Scripts, Ford, lots of companies coming out. JetBlue, Merck, Panera Bread, Twitter. And then Wednesday, we're going to have the Fed coming out with their statement of potentially what they'll be doing in terms of interest rates. Well, I don't think there's anything going to happen there. But, you know, usually when the Fed does talk, there is movement in the markets, whatever they say. So we'll look at that. We're going to see earnings from AutoNation, Buffalo Wild Wings. Ferrari is coming out already. They just had an IPO last week. You don't usually see earnings so fast after an IPO. It's kind of interesting that Ferrari is coming out with that so quickly. Garmin, GoPro which will be very interesting to watch to see if GoPro actually can do a little bit better than they have. The stock has been on a wild ride, down considerably this year, down I think it's down about 50% this year itself or so, about 70% from its high. And then we'll see some areas that are going to be interesting to look at, like the Marriott, Norfolk Southern in terms of transportation, and Starwood Hotels and Resorts. So we're going to see a little bit into the area of the consumer discretionary and hotels and lodging, which will be important to take a look at in terms of what is the overall consumer expenditures and what are they looking like on a global basis. Now, Thursday, we're going to see the first estimate of the quarter three GDP, which there is a wide range of estimates there, probably looking at 2% or so when it comes to GDP, a bit of a tick down from last quarter. And we're going to see Aetna in terms of earnings, Baidu, Coca-Cola, Electronic Arts, Expedia. We're going to see the travel sector again. LinkedIn, which has had a rough time after earnings lately. MasterCard, which just lost a major deal. Starbucks, Sherwin-Williams. Now, Sherwin-Williams came out with an interesting dividend increase last week. And when I saw that, it was kind of a warning flag that, man, I wonder if their earnings are going to be a problem, because oftentimes when you see that a company very close to earnings comes out with some kind of either an earnings, a dividend, or maybe even a buyback before, got to question what's going on there. We're also going to see Friday personal spending figures and the final University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. And we're going to start seeing some more of the big oil companies come out with earnings. We got Chevron and Exxon, Phillips 66 as well, all on that day. So that's what's going to be coming up next week. We got lots more to talk about, but I want to get to our guest. When we get back after our guest, we're going to talk about Volkswagen, talk about Fitbit and the big announcement with Weight Watchers, some of the things that are going on in terms of Twitter. But right now, let's get to our guest. And with us today is John Stein. He's the CEO and founder of Betterment. He's involved in a very hot area of finance these days, and I thought it would be a really good idea to bring him on to explain a little bit more about his company and the concept of what his company is doing. So, John, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to be with you.
Thanks. So tell me, you know, let's set the stage up for our listeners. What is Betterment and what are you doing?
Betterment is the largest and the fastest growing automated investing service. We created this category when we launched back in 2010. And I'll tell you sort of how we think about what we do. Our customers come to us most often at the recommendation of a friend or a family member, and they tell us about their goals. And based on those goals, and they could be things like, I want to make a down payment on a house, I'm saving for retirement, I just want to build wealth. Based on those goals and the time horizon to those goals, we create portfolios for them, we manage those portfolios over time to reduce costs, to reduce taxes, to manage risk. It's appropriate for the time horizon and the nature of that particular goal. Mm-hmm. So we manage your money for you. We're a digital advisor. Sometimes we're called a robo advisor, which is kind of a funny thing. I mean, I think it's like tongue in cheek. It's like, oh, you know, you could go to a human advisor, you could go to a robo advisor. We think of that as you know, sort of a false choice, because most people in this country can't afford really real advisors. Maybe 0.2% of the U.S. population has a real fiduciary advisor who's got their best interests in mind. Well, Betterment is a fiduciary advisor. We put our customers' best interests first. And for the first time in history, we've made that accessible to anyone and everyone in this country.
So I don't mean to make it sound like, oh, it's this mass-produced concept of advice when it comes to investing. But, you know, the thing is, can you actually get down to the point of personalizing individual portfolios? Or maybe is it your philosophy that's not really that important to do? Or how does that work?
Yeah, we personalize the portfolio for every customer. There's 75 million American investors, and there's 75 million unique portfolios available at Betterment. It's not just the portfolio, though. Sometimes people think that's the important thing when you're investing, is your portfolio. That's a very old-fashioned way of thinking about it. And it's there because that's all that a typical person or a typical advisor had time to think about. because, you know, it's expensive to use a person's time to help you plan, and all they can do in a 2-hour session is come up with a portfolio and then, hey, I'll see you next year and we'll talk about your portfolio again. Betterment is much smarter and more personalized than that. So we'll tell you how much to save, which accounts to open, how much to contribute each month. We'll monitor you every day to make sure that you're on track to your goal. We'll tax manage that account for you. We'll tax loss harvest for you. We'll help you avoid any wash sales coming in or out of the account. So this is daily, automated, you know, in truly comprehensive financial advice, taking into account your own financial situation, your spouse's financial situation, your income, your each of your goals, your Social Security benefits if you have them. Much more comprehensive than most people are used to getting.
So I know you do, as you mentioned, this goal-based, we'll keep saying goal-based investing. And is there a difference between that? So I guess we would say goal-based investing is college. You know, I'm saving for, as you mentioned, saving for college, saving for retirement, saving to buy a house in 8 years or whatever it may be, saving for a wedding. Is there a difference between goal-based investing and investing based on risk tolerance?
Yes. Yeah. It's a great distinction that you point out. So there's kind of an old-fashioned thought that, you know, if you give somebody like a risk tolerance survey, you can come up with, you know, the right portfolio for them. And some of these surveys, you know, listen, some of them are well designed and some of them do probably have statistically significant results. Most of them and most of the literature about those kinds of surveys says that they're not time consistent and they're not consistent across different people with similar needs. So, for instance, if the market is going up and I ask you a question, hey, what's your risk tolerance from 1 to 7? Like, most people, first of all, don't even know what that means. What is a 7 versus 5?
Right.
And you might say, if the market's going up, you might put down, well, I'm a 7. And then when the market's down, you say, oh, I'm a 2. Mm-hmm. People don't tend to be stable over time. So we've gotten rid of that sort of old-fashioned concept. We think it's a silly way to manage people's money. Instead, we ask you about your goals. And all that matters is the time horizon of those goals. And then we show you, based on what your inputs are, how risky your investments are likely to be. If you want to make changes, then you can make those changes in the context of the outcomes that are likely to happen based on the changes that you're making.
So there was something that was popularized a number of years ago called target rate funds, or, you know, these inside of particularly inside of 401ks, you had this target age or target date funds where you would say, well, I'm going to retire in 2035. And supposedly what would happen in those kind of portfolios, same thing with a lot of the 529 plans, is that, well, in the beginning, if you were young enough, you would have mostly stocks. That was the concept. And as you would go and get along the time horizon, as you would get closer and closer to the date in which you would be actually accessing your money, it would rotate more and more into bonds and into cash. That was the kind of big hoop-de-doo that was created with these target-based funds, right?
Right.
You know, that was the whole thing. One of the problems, by the way, that I always had with that was, okay, so I'm planning for retirement. I'm 40 years old, and I'm going to have all these equities. Okay, fine. And let's just say everything works out just fine. You get to retirement, no big hiccups in the portfolio. And all of a sudden, the theory is that things change entirely with how you should be investing. You should be all bonds, let's say, or a lot of cash. And it kind of didn't sit right with me because I'm like, well, wait a minute. Why would you do something like that if you're investing not only for your income, for you, and then potentially passing on to the next generation, with the only thing being different, the fact that you're not working and can't recoup it, of course, if you take a major loss. But is that kind of what you were looking at also saying, well, that's kind of a silly thing?
Yeah, that's right. And when you're in those target date funds, I mean, there's lots of great research about these as well, that sometimes they were really bad for investors who didn't understand, A, how much risk was in them as they were approaching retirement, or that they ended up, because of the way that they're structured, they ended up selling because they were more volatile than people thought. People sold them at the bottom. And ended up with a lot less in terms of retirement savings than they hoped they would have. There are problems with them. And I think the problems are rooted in the fact that they're really not all that personalized for your situation. You're in a bucket, with 5 million of your closest peers.
Mm-hmm.
They're good in the sense that they kind of take away the asset allocation decision. They take that burden off of people, and that's, you know, it is a burden, and they served that purpose. But in our view, they didn't go far enough in personalizing it. So Betterment actually personalizes a portfolio for every individual for your particular goals. And if you are approaching retirement, but you know what, you've decided that you're going to work a bunch of extra years, you don't have to sell that fund and buy a different fund. You just change your retirement date, and we start managing your portfolio differently. Again, it's personalized for you. We don't have to, like, you know, create any taxable events or move any money around in order to personally manage a portfolio for you.
Right. I mean, obviously, this relies on a very significant amount of technology that you've developed, obviously.
Yeah, look, we've spent 7 or 8 years now building out our platform, and it's I sometimes call it like an iceberg. There's this sort of like simple, easy user experience that you see, and then below the surface, there are hundreds of different programs running to help optimize your tax situation, to make sure that that trading is working well and rebalancing is operating in the most optimal way for you. All of these kinds of things are happening, and it is a big investment in technology. We have built all the plumbing of finance. We've built the banking APIs, the tax APIs, the statements, all of the core rails that run financial services. We built from scratch. And by doing that, we've been able to build a better user experience than anybody else can deliver. Better than Schwab, better than Vanguard, better than E-Trade, better than all the sort of legacy financial firms, because they're operating on technology that's now 30, 40, 50 years old. We've built brand new rails to support a new era of investing for all the new technology that's out there, for all the new instruments that are out there, like ETFs. This is a much better way to invest.
You know, I have a little bit of experience looking at some of these out there, and I know that what they basically did was just put they plugged in a user interface on the front end with a very, I would say, an unsophisticated back end in terms of how they're going to, you know, create this investment experience for people. And of course, we know that also that different players out there utilize different processes to look at, okay, well, what is your portfolio going to look like? Some have a, you know, 4, 5, 6 question and answer kind of interface that says, okay, you answer these questions and that's your portfolio. Some have, like you said, more of a target base, whereas a goal based, I guess we'd call it for your situation now. But many of them, And the majority of them really use passive investments like ETFs. That's what you use, right?
That's right. Primarily. Everything in our portfolio is exchange-traded funds. And we do that because they're more efficient than mutual funds. They're lower cost. They're more liquid.
So how do you – here's the question that I think you get maybe from the traditional advisor who is, you know, trying to fight this and says, well, you know, one of the big things – and again, I'm talking traditional now – is that – when clients get really concerned about markets coming down and, you know, or maybe a crash or whatever's going on out there, right? A war, who knows what. One of the things is that I'm here, an advisor saying this, I'm here to, you know, say, well, you know what, stay the course and everything's going to be fine, blah, 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 blah. How do you do that in terms of, obviously, you don't have the manpower to make all these calls and all that. What do you think is going to be the experience if and when something like that happens? And how do you keep people on the psychological side making sure that they understand that, hey, here's your goal. Nothing's changed right now over the long term.
So I think first off, there's a common misconception out there that we somehow compete with advisors. We don't. We are a fiduciary advisor, and we support hundreds of advisory firms on our platform. So we have a direct-to-consumer offering that anybody can come to Betterment.com and sign up for. But also many advisors use our Betterment institutional platform, and they brand it as their own offering, and then they sell our technology and our sophistication to their clients. So it makes their jobs easier. So we don't compete with advisors. We offer advisory services to those who haven't had them in the past, and we also partner with advisors to make their services better.
Mm-hmm.
In the situation that you're talking about, so clients, you know, panicking when markets are volatile, We have great data from the recent volatility that we saw this year, that shows that our customers reacted actually quite well to that. They did not go and run and change their allocations. They did not rush out the doors or some of these things that people predicted they might do. In fact, they stayed the course. They realized that they were still on track to their goals. They followed our advice. And we've built a lot of smart behavioral improvements into the site to help people make better decisions along the way. We actually think that we do a better job of that than any sort of broker would do for you. A broker, I mean, I've talked to people about the recent volatility, and they said, yeah, my broker called me up and said, hey, I wanted to talk to you about how I could reposition your portfolio given the volatility. Well, that's exactly what you shouldn't be doing. That's exactly the wrong behavior. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of brokers are selling. And you know, obviously that's that damages customers' returns.
Yeah, well, clearly if they're looking to, if these are transaction-based or commission-based brokers, obviously they feed upon the fact that you have fear and you have concern, and moving you around a little bit here and there creates a, you know, kicks up commissions for them. That's not the best thing in the world. One of the things that I thought was interesting was that in terms of your use of ETFs, so, you know, ETFs obviously are, as I call them, passive or active, passive or index-based investing. Have you had any thoughts about bringing on any kind of active managers into your platform at all?
So we are not dogmatic about being passive. It happens that all of the ETFs that we use are passive index ETFs, but we don't think that, you know, there's some, you know, it's been handed down from on high that passive management will always be the right thing, or that this particular portfolio will always be the right one. What the reason we got to where we are with the recommendations of the ETFs that we have is that we're evidence-based, and we're evidence-based in everything that we do. So we've looked at all of the data that's out there. We've looked at all of the different asset classes you could own, and we've chosen the best assets in each asset class based on the lowest cost, the least tracking error, the most liquidity. Those all happen to be passive funds, and it's common knowledge at this point that net of fees, passive investments tend to outperform active investments for most retail investors mm-hmm. and in most retail situations. That's not to say that there are not hedge fund managers or private equity investors or individual investors who can't go out and pick stocks better than the average mutual fund manager. It is to say that net of fees, the average mutual fund manager significantly underperforms a passive fund. That's just what the data tells us. And we follow that data and use that data to create the best returns for our customers.
You know, what's really interesting is you've revolutionized the whole investment experience, right? You would agree with that, right? You've revolutionized the whole idea of how people can invest, but you're still sticking to the whole idea of benchmarking everything to an index. And I just wonder if one day somebody's going to come along and say, you know what, that's not the way to invest.
It's a great point. It becomes very hard to benchmark against an index when you're talking about a globally diversified portfolio. How do you, you know, what is the right index to compare your Betterment account to? What we've done is we've created this globally diversified portfolio. You own a little bit of everything. It's like owning every company in the world, which is the way that you want to invest. That's how you get the most return with the least risk. Diversification is the one true free lunch in investing. And so this is the right thing to do. But to create an index, you basically have to own the Betterment portfolio. So we almost are, you know, we are the global index. Nobody has yet created a global market-weighted index. It doesn't exist. You have to use country-specific or even, you know, region-specific indices. And so there's not a perfect benchmark for us. Instead, we use a bunch of things. We use the regional indices, so you can see how we compare to different regions and different asset classes. And you can see things like, well, how many tax losses have we harvested for you? How many dividends have you collected? So we look at these other types of return to get to a more holistic picture of all the services that we provide as your investment advisor.
No, that's good stuff. Well, I appreciate you spending time with us, John Stein, again, CEO and founder of Betterment. We'll make sure that the links to the website and information about where to find out more information on Betterment are on this edition's show notes. Thanks a lot. Hopefully we'll talk to you soon again. Appreciate it.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye. And just a reminder that all the information about our guest from Betterment will be on the show notes over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So make sure to check that out and to go spend a little time on some of the past podcasts as well. There's been a lot of great guests and commentary. You can always download those over at iTunes or on any other podcast network to make sure that you get them quickly. You can also follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the Twitter handle, and we usually will make sure that that podcast, when it comes out, usually on Sunday, midday to evening, depending on how production goes, that you'll be the first to know about it and you can get it immediately. Well, before we cut and went to our guest, I had mentioned there was a few things I want to talk about. And I guess we could start with this interesting story out of Twitter. Twitter has been doing a bit better recently, and stock has popped up ever since Jack Dorsey took the part-time CEO. You know, he's also a part-time CEO over at Square. Laid off about 8% of the workforce, released this Moments edition, trying to figure out a way to make sure that Twitter is profitable, can increase their user base and membership, etc. Well, last week, he announced that he's giving away one-third of his stock, 33% of his stock that he owns in Twitter, to Twitter company employees. I thought that was kind of interesting, about $200 million worth, and the guy's doing very well. He's got plenty of money, and he's, of course, he has his IPO of Square coming out soon, so that's going to be something that's going to be pretty good for him. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting with regard to this was that, you know, how do you look at this? Do you look at this as, wow, this is a great guy that really is looking as, I guess he is putting this out there to make sure that he's spreading the wealth to his employees, 92% of them, of course, because I don't think the other 8% that were recently fired and let go are going to get any of this. Hoping to increase morale and give a big part of the company's opportunity in the future to employees. Or on the other hand, it's just like, hey, I don't want this crap. I don't want this stock. Let me give this away. I'll keep what I got over at Square and the IPO. I'm going to bet on that. But this Twitter thing is really not going to do great, so I can get a big tax deduction possibly for it now on this nice number, and I'll collect on the Square deal. I don't know. Kind of an interesting situation. I'm not sure what you think. You can always write me over at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll take a look at that. Maybe I try to get to every question I can and answer you directly back personally. Let's talk about Volkswagen for a second. Volkswagen actually, I think, is coming up with their earnings on, I think it's on Wednesday. Already there's been about, talk about $3.5 billion of losses that will come in. And there's been a scramble on to separate Volkswagen from the other properties of the Volkswagen car, that is, that particular property, from the other car brands that Volkswagen owns, and like Audi and a few others, some of the high-end brands, saying, you know, this is very isolated. And in the beginning, of course, it was like, well, we didn't know. This guy, who knows how this happened? Now there's been six engineers that have been suspended, and there is the potential for more digging to go on and more engineers and management's heads to roll. There seems that there is a very significant amount of, I guess you got to call it conspiracy. I'm not sure what else you would call it, that was going on, because not only was it just one technology that they were using that was identified in one particular engine that would trick the emissions tests to read that they were whatever levels that needed to be when the emissions test was going on, and then turn off entirely and then spew out all those bad emissions and all the mileage that was beneficial, et cetera. It changed the whole dynamic of the car, but only when it was on the emissions test would it actually kick in this technology to, again, to fool the emissions testing. But every time there was a new generation of cars, every time there was a change in the particular engine in these TDI diesels, they would have to change the technology that would employ this trickery on the emissions test. So not only was it one time or two times, it was many times. And in fact, they were going to do some releasing of their 2016 versions of all this, and I guess it hit a roadblock. They're very concerned about some of the engineering that's going on and possibly, I guess, having to reverse some of the technology on this, and they're pretty scared. I think there is a lot more behind this, and there's a lot more that's going to be found out. Where there's smoke, there's fire. in a really oddball way, it reminds me of the whole lumber liquidators deal, where at first they were denying it. Oh, this couldn't be. We're not sourcing any bad hardwood floors or laminates from China that have too much formaldehyde. No. Your tests are wrong. Things are wrong. Yeah, they did step up in the beginning and say, okay, yeah, okay, hold on. They got ahead of it and said, yes, we do see there's a problem. Yes, there is a scandal. Yes, the CEO stepped down. There's investigations going on. But now, I mean, it's probably just a small little oversight or maybe even a bad egg engineer that put this on and nobody else noticed it somehow. Well, now all of a sudden, a few more coming out. And who knows what the actual cost, because the mandatory recall in Germany for about 11 million vehicles. And we haven't even seen what the total cost of this deal is going to be. And more so, more, you know, beyond the cost, beyond the actual cost of the recall to fix this deal, is all the class action lawsuits that are going to go due to the fact that you have cars that are not worth as much, the tainting of the brand and the lack of the overall, I guess it would be consumers' desire to get near a Volkswagen, because who knows what else they're cheating on. And now there's even a investigation into the claims and to their accident-free and their injury reports, because they have, like, I guess it's about 10 times less injuries in Volkswagens than any other car brand. So there's some investigation going on there now, too. So now what's going to happen is that there's going to be a big dig in by regulators looking to find what else is going on inside of this company. Now, last week we saw, I thought this was really cool. This is great. Talked about this on DH Unplugged a bit with John C. Dvorak. And we talked about the whole Weight Watchers announcement by Oprah, who bought 10% of the company. And the company, the first day, moved up by 100%. The excitement that Oprah was going to be involved in this and promoting it and taking a ownership piece of this company was just overwhelming. And I thought a brilliant move, frankly. And then by the end of the second day, it was up almost, I think, close to 200% from where it started the day before. You got this Oprah effect. This remember the book club? Remember all the things that when Oprah says to buy or to do? I mean, really gave a major spark to whatever the underlying product was. She has close to about, I guess, worldwide, about 25 million followers between her magazines and her various Oprah network, television network, as well as just a tremendous amount of fans and following, a lot of trust as well. So here's what I thought was really interesting, that stock kind of came off the third day or so, which would be expected, a little bit of profit taking there. But by Friday, when the announcement came that Oprah already lost 15 pounds by being on Weight Watchers, the stock turned around from a little bit of a loss to take a nice gain. So what you're seeing is not only the buy-in on this, but the buy-in from investors on the fact that Oprah will be able to do an amazing thing by just promoting this whole deal. Now, obviously, if she starts to gain weight, it's going to be a big problem. if she goes off the wagon, which she does, she goes up and down in weight a lot. We know that. She admits it. It's no secret here. What may be a positive thing for the stock could turn out to be a negative. But nonetheless, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about this whole dynamic that they could create. Already Weight Watchers, if you go to their website, you'll see that they already integrate the Fitbit into their sales. They sell the Fitbit for a discount for Weight Watchers members, and they integrate the Fitbit into some of their programming. I thought it would be really cool if Oprah would actually go out and then cross-promote the Fitbit, which, by the way, I have mentioned that I'm not a really big fan of Fitbit, but in this changes the dynamic entirely, because now all of a sudden the potential for Oprah to bring in a consolidated approach to weight loss and, in this particular circumstance, the Fitbit device for tracking of your weight, maybe with their scale, tracking of your exercise and your sleep, etc., and then providing a website and something like, you may see a headline says something like this: Oprah fans lose 2 million pounds in the last month. Because what they're getting is all the feedback from Weight Watchers and the scales that are aligned with the Fitbit. And then Oprah fans exercise, jog an average of 6 miles per hour for 185,000 miles over the last week, or whatever the particular thing they want to put out there. But if they do this, this could be a really cool conglomeration of the whole idea of weight loss, exercise, and of course, clean living. Now, it also comes at a great time if you think about it. We're in October. November, December, great gift idea. And of course, let's not forget that everybody makes New Year's resolutions, and a lot of people have dieting as one of their top New Year's resolutions. And that's when you see that Weight Watchers, Nutrisystem, and other places like fitness clubs, gyms, they get a lot of business that time of year. So you get this first quarter bump that's just the natural process because people are making New Year's resolutions, or they're doing something different for the new year because it is that demarcation point they could easily see. And I thought it would be really interesting to see if there is going to be some kind of a coordination in a much tighter fashion between Oprah, Weight Watchers, and Fitbit at this point. So I'd keep a watch on at least that thesis. I think it's going to be very interesting to keep a look at and to see if there's going to be any kind of a liftoff, if you will, due to this. It just seems like a logical, if not logical, by the way, and if they haven't thought of this already, please do so, because I think it's a great idea, keeping people healthy and making sure that they stay in a reasonable weight and good for the heart, good for, you know, the body, good for longevity and all that. So, Oprah, if you're listening, because I know you're a big fan, Oprah, of course, Oprah listens every week to this show, right? But nonetheless, I think this would be a really cool thing. All right, we're going to end it there. We have some great guests coming up in the next few weeks that are booked. And make sure that you tune in each and every Sunday. Download this. Of course, you can find it on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, as I mentioned earlier. If you are a trader, if you're using TradeStation, they have a pretty cool promotion going on. You can check out what's going on there. But the thing that I want to mention about that is, of course, our various algorithms and our indicators through trigger charts that we built. The Commander Series is on TradeStation. You have our Aileron, which is a momentum and trending indicator. Very cool algorithm. As well as a very neat suite of understanding where the actual buying pressure by institutions is. So you can understand where support and resistance is in a much different way that is presented than you usually would see. So we automatically build all that into the screen. So if you're not checked out TradeStation, I encourage you to do so and download the various trials, at least from Trigger Charts. We even have an economic charting package that's actually free on the platform that we put out, as well as a few other things that will help you in your investing and trading. Well, thanks for joining me. I'll see you next week. And if you have any questions, please do send me an email, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and tell your friends. Tell a lot of your friends, do a quick email to them, do a quick tweet out there for me. Listen to the Disciplined Investor podcast. Hopefully people will learn a bit and get better educated in the area of investing. That's what we're here for. Give you a little bit of an edge, hopefully, in the markets and a little bit of entertainment at the same time. Well, thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.